From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, another candidate for governor sits down pre-primary to talk about priorities. Today, it's Democrat Jocelyn Benson.
Well, my goal as governor will be to ensure we drive down costs of everything from healthcare to housing to energy costs and childcare.
Then a nursing professor at MSU talks about the challenges of flagging mental health issues among men.
All of a sudden, they go from being very outgoing to very withdrawn. Where they're very withdrawn and then all of a sudden they're really outgoing. Sometimes there's some masking going on when they have some underlying feelings of depression.
And one writer shares his experiences with Amish, Mennonite, and other communities of simple faith.
The retention rate among the Amish is over 80%. Unlike most groups, their birth rate has not fallen.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, one writer shares his experiences writing about communities that have fascinated him for decades, including Amish and Mennonites. That's coming up in just a bit, but first, Michigan's 2026 primary election is on August 4th, and voting is already underway. Michigan will elect a new governor this fall. In the primary, voters will be choosing the nominees who will actually appear in the November election. As part of Michigan Public's election 2026 coverage, we're speaking with candidates for governor from both major parties. Jocelyn Benson has served as Michigan's Secretary of State since 2019. Now she's also a Democratic candidate for governor. She spoke recently with Morning Edition host Doug Tribue.
What will your top three priorities be if you are elected governor?
Well, my goal as governor will be to ensure we drive down costs of everything from healthcare to housing to energy costs and childcare, build our economy to grow wages and protect our communities, whether it's at the ballot box when protecting democracy or protecting the safety of our schools, places of worship, and being prepared to stand up to anyone who would get in the way of that, but also work with anyone to get things done. And I'll add, as the daughter of two public school teachers and as a former teacher myself and as a mom, it's really critical to me to do all of these things that we improve our public education system.
In January, you also laid out your healthcare policy agenda, calling healthcare a defining issue, and you made affordability the center of that agenda. How would you make healthcare more affordable for Michiganders?
Well, we have to, first of all, recognize that far too many families are struggling to make ends meet. And too often that means they can't pay for life-saving services. So our Department of Health and Human Services needs to be streamlined to ensure we're driving down costs and work together with hospitals and stakeholders to ensure prescription drugs in particular are lower and insurance is actually covering our needs. We also need to focus on the needs of our rural communities, where you've seen far too many hospital closures drive up costs and decrease accessibility. So one of the things I've proposed is forming mobile healthcare clinics that can come to communities that are healthcare deserts and provide affordable, accessible care.
You touched on this briefly there, but you have said during your campaign that to make your health plan come together, that MDHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, would need to be overhauled to be brought into sort of the modern era. That in and of itself sounds like a major project before having them run this major project of overhauling healthcare in the state. Is that something you're confident can happen on both ends?
Yeah. So, you know, when I came into the Secretary of State's office, many said it couldn't be done, but we actually did transform the DMV, the butt of so many jokes of government inefficiency and bureaucracy. And in just 18 months, we were able to eliminate wait times, put self-service stations in grocery stores, and move more services online to streamline how the office works. A lot of that requires someone who knows how to run massive agencies and is accustomed to taking on big projects and modernizing systems. That's what I've done for most of my career. So I'm ready to tackle one of these biggest issues that, frankly, other states have figured out, and we can take a lot of their best practices and implement them here.
As Secretary of State, your office is responsible for conducting the same election that you're running in now for governor. And in May, you announced a new firewall policy with help from the nonprofit Election Reformers Network. How is that firewall different from the way you recused yourself during your reelection campaign for Secretary of State in 2022?
It's actually not. It's the same way that we ensured when I was a candidate for office in the past for re-election, that we had a separation between any election-related decisions and my work elsewhere in the department. What we've done differently really is just more effectively and openly talk about those firewalls so that people can have that rightly placed faith.
One of the most hotly contested topics in Michigan and across the country right now is the construction of large-scale data centers. If elected governor, how would you approach data center projects and potential legislation about them?
So I've released a data center guardrail plan to ensure this transformation delivers prosperity and affordability, and have called for a moratorium to be in place to ensure we are taking our time in evaluating how we as Michigan want to take our opportunity to do this right. Any new corporation that's bringing jobs to a community has to be responsible for our environment, our water, our energy rates, and the people we serve.
Where do you see the power to decide in the ongoing push-pull between state and local control? It's one of the recurring themes of my time here over the past decade in news stories we cover, not just related to data centers, but related to many topics. Where is the line in your mind related to data centers on who really has that final say?
I think the local residents, not just talking about whether they want any corporation to come to their community, but also investing and engaging in community benefit agreements and negotiations to ensure if a corporation were to come to a community, that they could be a part of being responsible in investing in better infrastructure and other things to improve communities.
You touched on employment earlier, and we've seen a lot of debate over what the state should or should not do to help attract and keep businesses in Michigan. One major point of contention is the Michigan Economic Development Corporation and its taxpayer-funded spending on private businesses. In your view, what does Michigan need to do to develop and maintain high-quality, high-paying jobs?
The bottom line for me is that we can be the economic engine of the Midwest here in Michigan if we diversify our economy, and we do that through investing in small business growth and development. The other thing we need to do to diversify our economy and attract new jobs to the state is invest in our workforce. That's why public education that prepares our young people for the jobs of tomorrow is critical. It's going to take far more than tax breaks or incentives to bring jobs to Michigan. It's all about workforce development and talent retention and creation. That's what I want to invest in as governor.
Do you think the tax breaks and incentives should continue, though, as they've been going on over the last several years and beyond?
I think we need to be serious and transparent about the return on investment of those incentives to ensure the money we're putting in to bring jobs to Michigan is actually returning on our investment in creating those jobs. Right now, we just put the money into those job creators, and we don't necessarily have a method of seeking accountability to whether or not those jobs are created. I would like to ensure we have accountability before any more funds get spent.
That was Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson talking with Michigan Public's morning host Doug Tribue. Our state needs more energy, specifically clean energy, to meet its goals for using fewer fossil fuels. So legislators 3 years ago passed a law called Public Act 233. It's meant to make it easier for developers to build these renewable projects by giving them some different avenues for approval. Interlochen Public Radio's climate solution reporter Vivian Law looks at how the law is changing the way local communities think about large renewable energy builds.
When Jake Kirby drives around 1,500 acres of farmland in Wexford Township, he doesn't just see rolling fields of squash, green beans, and cattle lands. He sees the place where he learned the ropes to farming and life.
This is where I grew up. This is where I cut my teeth. My college education was on the farm.
Early plans from a renewable energy developer could line this 1,500 acres that borders his family's home with solar arrays.
Yep, so basically from here to that white roofed house, this entire section would be in the solar panels.
The local planning commission is reviewing a zoning amendment that could push the project forward. Kirby sees a different option.
I by no means want this project to go through. But if it does, with the state zoning, it's something that I can live with. I feel like the state has more authority and money to put towards, this is their green initiative, they can clean up the fallout from it.
State approval is possible under Michigan's Public Act 233, which limits local government's ability to flat out reject large-scale renewable energy projects. The law lays out two avenues for permitting. Developers have to start with local permitting. If there's a local ordinance for these big renewable energy projects, that's compatible with state law. The second avenue, any other ordinance, would give developers the option to go to the state.
I got a copy of the law. It's very dog-eared.
Sarah Mills directs the University of Michigan's Center for Empowering Communities, which studies land use and energy. She's read the law many times. Mills says the reality is that very few local governments are choosing the compatible state ordinance. Instead, most are writing up their own ordinances that developers could work with, in theory.
What's workable to one developer might not be workable to another developer, and so it's kind of an art rather than a science of figuring out what is a workable ordinance.
Green Lake Township in Grand Traverse County is one of those governments trying to figure it out. Marvin Radke is the township supervisor. He says the township is consulting with legal experts to write a workable ordinance because they want to keep decisions in the community.
We take great pride in balancing individual property rights along with the community's right in regards to what we would like to see in 20 years. And it's a very fine line to walk.
He says Public Act 233 changes the boundaries of local control.
It is going to be a challenge. Is it harder? It's new. It's something different.
There are some municipalities who might prefer to leave ordinances as they are. That would defer permitting to the state. Lila Hollis, clean energy specialist with the nonprofit Groundwork Center, says that these projects can be a lot of work for local officials.
These local control projects take a lot of time. You have to host public hearings. There's a lot of paperwork. You have to work with the developer off hours, you know, all that kind of thing. So it's understandable that some of them would just rather have the developer go through the state.
She says there's not one right answer. This is the choice that Public Act 233 has introduced. A representative for Ranger Power, the company developing the Wexford Township solar array, says the most successful projects are built on community partnerships. The company prefers the local permitting process. Kirby, the township resident, says he'll keep paying attention to the proposed solar project.
I would tell people to pay attention to laws that are being passed and consider how they're going to affect you.
Still, Kirby is convinced that solar will end up in the township either way, no matter how much he wants to see this area stay as farmland. For IPR News, I'm Vivian Law.
We're going to take a short break now. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend, take a look at your man behind the grill. He's on top of things, flipping burgers for the gang, making sure everybody's got something to drink. He's tuning in the game on Bluetooth so everyone can listen, and making sure the kids aren't chasing the ball into the street. But how is he really doing? Men do not self-report depression as frequently as women do. And the reasons for that may go beyond actual prevalence of depression and other mental health issues. Michael Martell is a clinical nurse specialist and an assistant professor at Michigan State University's College of Nursing. And men's mental health is one of his special areas of focus. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So like you mentioned, I'm an assistant professor at Michigan State University. I'm also our faculty advisor for our men in nursing group at Michigan State as well. And, you know, depression is a really important topic to raise awareness about, especially with men, because men often experience, as you mentioned, you know, they may experience different symptoms than women do. And so it's really important to raise awareness of some of those things, things like irritability or maybe some anger, even substance use or, you know, alcohol or, you know, drug use, those kind of things. Those can kind of creep in because a lot of times men aren't very comfortable speaking about how they're feeling inside. And so a lot of times they try to mask those things by maybe partaking in, you know, alcohol, drugs, or, you know, doing, you know, being very irritable, or, you know, even just a change in behavior sometimes can be a sign of depression in men. So it's important to check in.
Let's start out with who gets screened. What do we know about whether and why men might consider themselves at risk for depression in different ways than women do.
Yeah, so I think men typically see themselves as needing to be like stronger or not, is maybe fearful to talk about their emotions and fearful to talk about what's going on. So when you talk about screening, a lot of times with the primary care provider, that's where that depression screening will go on. But whether or not men will disclose how they're truly feeling is, I think, is something that's worth talking about, is whether they're feeling comfortable to disclose how they feel.
Yeah. I know guys who might say, you know, life is just rough and inherently depressing. So what is the point of trying to do something about it? Is that something that you sometimes hear in clinical practice?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they try to normalize it, or, you know, this is something that I can just get through on my own, or this is something that I don't need to seek help for. I can get through this. This is something I can work through. And so they kind of think that they can work through it on their own. And so they may not seek help, you know, either that's professional support or that kind of thing. They won't seek help.
Yeah. Are there signs that you look for when you're seeing patients if guys maybe seem like they're keeping a stiff upper lip?
Yeah. So I would say, well, first off, if they're being a little more quiet than usual, because they may not be talking about it, but they're internalizing it. Also changes in behavior. Like we see like irritability, maybe some anger. Or even if there starts to be an increase in like substance use with like alcohol or drugs, those kind of things, because they're trying to kind of self-treat their depression that they have going on rather than seeking help, because they don't want it to be seen as a sign of weakness.
Do you think there are reasons why primary care providers or family members or even the patients themselves might miss the symptoms? Or if they just, you know, if you ask and you hear back, no, I'm doing all right, you know, just kind of a big week. Do you think there are reasons why we sometimes miss those symptoms?
Yeah, because I think they're not characteristic of what we normally think of. When we think about depression, we may see like visual sadness, or, you know, they may be upset or crying a lot, or being very upset or withdrawn. We may not see that all the time, and it manifests differently. And we might see things like, you know, like I mentioned, irritability, anger, and those kind of things that we don't typically see, that we don't typically think of, at least when we think about depression. And so it's important to kind of change the conversation so that way we can really have those open conversations and dialogue if we see those things occurring, or even just changes in behavior. You know, maybe they're behaving, you know, all of a sudden they go from being very outgoing to very withdrawn, or you know, or they're very withdrawn and then all of a sudden they're really outgoing, and they're, you know, sometimes there's some masking going on when they have some underlying feelings of depression and they're trying to mask it.
What might you say to someone who feels reticent about seeking treatment, who maybe says that they don't have time, you know, that they're under a lot of pressure, they've got a lot of obligations. Maybe they're the breadwinner. Maybe they're taking care of kids. Maybe they're also taking care of their parents. Or who might have concerns about being labeled as someone who is depressed.
Yeah, and I think, and you mentioned about labeling just now, you know, that stigma that we sometimes have with mental illness, and it comes along with it. You know, sometimes I think that's a lot of times a barrier to seeking treatment, and in realizing that there's a lot of accessible options. So nowadays we have telehealth. There's telehealth, there's in-person, there's telehealth, there's even employee resources that a lot of employers have, that there's access to. So there's resources there. And sometimes even just, you know, they can provide some strategies to work on. And it may not even need like medications or those kind of things. It may just be a conversation, some things that they need to work on, maybe some deep breathing, guided imagery, some things that they can work on when they're really starting to feel either stressed or very depressed.
Mike, do you think that I tend to think of the industries where men are, you know, make up a disproportionate part of the workforce, like airline pilots, where sometimes there are some actual restrictions on you if you do self-identify as someone who's dealing with some stuff. What are some ways that you work with people who might have those kinds of concerns?
Yeah, you know, one thing that comes to mind when you say that about airline pilots, another one, a friend of mine is actually a police officer, and he's been doing a lot of raising awareness about mental health issues within his colleagues at the police department. They've been meeting about these things, and they actually have been raising a lot of awareness on this, because those things are seen as, sometimes they don't want to share that with their coworkers. They don't want to share that they're having issues, because it can be seen as a sign of weakness. And especially in professions like, you know, into police departments, fire departments, those kind of things where they need to be seen as, you know, a rock, and, you know, somebody that can, you know, go into, you know, if it's a fireman going into a burning building or a police officer running into a dangerous situation, and they don't want to sometimes admit that they're vulnerable and that they're experiencing some of these things. But sometimes, you know, really having those conversations, or even having those conversations within their community groups. So this police officer, I was just talking to him just the other day about this. I told him I was interviewing. He told me, feel free to share. He actually has a support group where there's like, you know, a good dozen other officers that come together, and they actually have those conversations, and they talk about things, and they've been through things like anger and irritability, but it's all stemmed from that depression that they didn't want to talk about for a long time. But now that they're normalizing that and they're having those conversations, it's really making a positive difference in their life. So I think having those conversations is really important, and being able to, you know, trust somebody to open up and share how you're really feeling, those kind of things.
Right. Mike, are there physical conditions that are associated with depression if it does go untreated for a long time?
Yeah. So those things, like, especially if somebody's like withdrawing, or they're, you know, not as physically active as they were, there could be like some cardiovascular effects, especially with, you know, when we think about depression, we often think about stress and those kind of things. And they can lead to some other health effects, you know, stroke. So there's other risk factors that play in there with depression.
Do you have a sense of how long it takes for the, you know, the psychological and emotional conditions of depression to manifest as health problems?
You know, I think sometimes it takes a little while, and I think that's why oftentimes depression is underdiagnosed, is because it doesn't often, it may be subtle at first, and we don't really see these things. And that's why it's really important when you're at the provider's office, they'll screen your mental health as well as your physical health, because a lot of times those really play in hand, and it's important that we're looking out for this in our patients.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about some of the techniques. Can you say more about what treatment for depression looks like, especially maybe for men who come into practice and may have some of these concerns?
Yeah. So a lot of times they may set them up with like a therapist or a counselor that they can talk through. There's a lot of like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, positive affirmations. There's lots of different things that they can do to kind of turn those negative thought processes around. Sometimes it can just be a downward spiral with those things. And then also there's the treatment side. So with a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner. And that would be for like if there's medication that are needed. So a lot of times we really try to look at really a holistic approach when we're treating somebody with depression. But a lot of times those tools that you can work with, like, you know, deep breathing, guided imagery, if they start to feel maybe a little anxious because of things that they're getting into a rut and they're really feeling things, or even just getting them to be in tuned with, if they recognize that they're being more irritable, okay, this might be a sign that I'm a little more depressed. Or if I'm, you know, because those symptoms are a little different, it's important to provide that education to our patients too, to say, hey, if you notice this in yourself, and even their family members, if you notice this, say something, because it may be a sign that the depression is maybe getting worse, especially during certain seasons and that kind of thing.
Interesting you say that. I tend to think of winter as being high season for depression, especially seasonal affective disorder. But do you run into people who have a hard time when the weather is nice and we're out being social a lot, like now?
I think the one thing to make sure to a good point is that, you know, depression can happen, you know, really these symptoms can manifest all throughout the year. So it doesn't have to be, we think of this like seasonal depression. That's only, you know, some patients with depression, not everybody experiences that same, has that same experience. So it's important that no matter what season we're in, we're always looking out for these signs. You know, you mentioned, well, somebody's barbecuing, if they're a little more withdrawn and they're not being as social, and you know, maybe they're drinking more often. You know, those are things that we really need to look out for, and just have those conversations and just check in and say, hey, you know, and I think that's so important too, that, you know, we develop those communities, you know, with people that, you know, have maybe gone through similar experiences where guys can share things with each other. Because I think a lot of times men are, they feel isolated. Like, I'm the only one that's feeling this way. I'm the only one that can feel like this. And when they have that community, they have others that say, no, you know what? I also felt like this. I felt like this. And that can be really powerful and can really empower them to be to get some treatment for the depression that they're experiencing.
If we know somebody who probably could use some help, but who's been resistant to going and talking to someone about it, do you have any advice either for the person who is, you know, sort of trying to tough it out, or for the person who's trying to help them seek treatment?
Yeah, I would say one thing is bringing awareness and letting them know like what you're seeing, right? Because sometimes they don't see it in themselves. And so just having that conversation, that open conversation, I've noticed this change in you lately. Is everything okay? You know, is there anything that you want to talk about? Having some open-ended conversations. And then if they start to share, that's when you kind of, you want to make sure that you get them in touch with somebody that like professional support. So, you know, either a psychiatrist or a therapist, even if they are having some really significant depression, unfortunately, suicide's really high in men because they don't seek help. And there's crisis support numbers for that and things that you can call if that's the case. But you do want to have those open-ended conversations and just kind of check in, but let them know what you're observing with their behavior and those changes that have occurred, because sometimes they're not aware of it themselves.
Mike Martell is a clinical nurse specialist and also teaches at Michigan State's College of Nursing. Mike, thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you so much for having me, April, and letting me raise awareness on this important topic.
Dementia, a condition that affects many Americans, is changing how we think about memory. In a new collection of verse called Dementia Lyrics, Michigan poet Dennis Hendrickson turns to neuroscience and prose to make sense of his own friend's decline. Writer John Freeman brings us this essay.
Dennis Hendrickson's new collection of poems, Dementia Lyrics, is a book about saying goodbye and so much more. Hendrickson's brilliance isn't limited to his wildly inventive prosody. His lines and phrases make Hockney-esque sketches across the page. But Hendrickson knows an incredible amount of information about neurology and medical science, which he presents in a surprisingly accessible way. Hendrickson is also a devil with language. I'm not some banjo-playing southern preacher pitching woo here barbed with Christ. But it's the tender warmth, Hendrickson's caring nature, that I really want to emphasize. This book is a set of elegies, poems that deal with death and loss. And the central thing Hendrickson is elegizing is the rapid senescence of a dear friend who is suffering from Lewy body dementia. Saying goodbye to loved ones, as we all know, is hard. But saying goodbye to a person's cognitive ability to say goodbye is tragic. And Hendrickson captures this tragedy with deep empathy and poignancy. In the poem Atrophic, he writes, "That friend's brain today, new diagnosis, therefore ataxia, central nervous system shutting down, autonomic dysfunction that is quivering." Elegy requires memory. So how do we elegize memory itself? This quandary necessitates a menu of unanswerable questions that leave us leaning into lived experiences, however fraught they are with impossible heartbreak. In the first poem, Hendrickson introduces us to engram theory, a hypothetical neurological concept that posits that our memories are stored in physical places in the brain. Friend cannot burn new engrams, we're told, and thus Hendrickson's caretaking finds its locus. For the poet suspects that perhaps simple, repetitive physical tasks might light up extant engrams and retrieve at least a few of his friend's most precious memories. If the poet can help the friend remember, the elegizing will find its mark. and the slow process of dying will not obliviate what was beautiful in this life. In the poem, he was a boy, he had a boat, this is the city of Niagara Falls, Heinrichsen introduces us to the concept of ekphoria delectica, which references the way a distant memory brings the rememberer pleasure. When he invokes his friend's past in the following address, Heinrichsen is attempting to enact the ekphoria delectica concept. Dear Lake Ontario, can you come out to play? I am calling. This is ekphoria delectica. I am offering all my voltage to bring you forth. He sailed you once. This sound is wind in canvas. And if it's just another cut-rate resurrection that poetry is anonymous me beating silence to death, I can live with that. Dementia Lyrics is that rare book that resonates with both fans of experimental poetry as well as anyone who has experienced the long goodbye of a loved one. Heinrichsen heightens language and improvises new poetic forms that he uses to ennoble and preserve our shared experiences so that we almost remember what's still good in us.
John Freeman teaches writing at Oakland University, and he publishes poetry and creative nonfiction under the name Cal Freeman. It's time to take a pause right now. When we return, we'll speak with an author who's observed and written about Amish, Mennonites, and others. Be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan has the sixth largest Amish population in the U.S., with nearly 20,000 residents spread across more than 50 settlements. If you've ever spent time in Centerville, in St. Joseph County, you've likely come across some of our Amish neighbors shopping at the local grocery or traveling the roads in horse-drawn buggies. Since their arrival in North America, the Amish way of life has remained largely unchanged. They choose to dress plainly and forego many technologies, electricity, cars, and tractors, although you do find those technologies cropping up in different kinds of communities. Their commitment is to preserve their culture without fear of assimilation. And it's something that's fascinated writer Kevin Williams for more than three decades. In his new memoir, Not So Simple, My Adventures Among the Amish, Mennonites, Shakers, and Other Plain People, Williams reflects on what he learned while exploring Amish settlements from Maine to Montana and nearly everywhere in between, including their traditional ways of cooking. Kevin, so good to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you start by setting the table a bit for the range of communities that you have? I mean, this has been a very long subject in your life, the geographic range of communities that you visited and interacted with.
I mean, I've literally been to Amish communities from Maine to Montana. I've been to the most conservative Amish communities, the most quote-unquote liberal Amish communities. They call them the electric Amish. They have electric.
Electric Amish.
They do call them that. I've been to German Baptists, which are often mistaken for Amish. I've spent time with them. Mennonites, who are often mistaken for Amish. I mean, I've been to them all.
Yeah, and this when I say that it's sort of a lifelong relationship for you, it's really true. Where did your interest in these communities begin?
It began actually with a high school English paper. We were supposed to pick a topic that we saw in the news and write a big research paper on it. And I happened to be flipping through USA Today and saw an article about the Amish and thought, oh, this seems interesting. And yeah, that launched something that lasted a long time.
What did you make of them as a young person?
For me, they were sort of mysterious. There weren't as many of them back then because their population doubles like every generation. You see these people in a horse and buggy and sort of living completely counter to the technology that we have, and it just kind of captivated me.
I think that was one of the learnings of the book for me, is that reminder, like, this is not a fading society in American tradition, that there are numbers in the Pennsylvania Dutch community's favor. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the retention rate among the Amish is over 80%. So when you have Amish families, unlike most groups their birth rate has not fallen. It's, you often have 7, 8, 9 kids per family. And if they're all staying, or almost all of them are staying, yeah, that's going to cause their population to double every generation. They're seeking out new places. First Amish community in North Dakota this year.
Oh, wow.
They're spreading throughout the country.
It's one thing to be curious and to be interested in the life and why people choose to stay in it. It's another thing entirely to develop the kind of relationships that you've had over time. Can you share a bit of what you shared in the book about how you drew closer?
Yeah, one of the centerpieces of the book and my story is that there was a syndicated column. It was so stupid in many ways because I was young. I was 18 when I came up with this column idea.
Yeah.
I had no clue how hard it was going to be. But I found an Amish woman who was willing to write this column, and we launched it. And, you know, newspapers started picking it up. And I'm like, oh, gosh, what do I do now? And it just sort of kept spreading to other newspapers. And at its peak, it was in 140 newspapers. And I was able to develop relationships with the family who wrote the column and just other Amish families that I met in my sort of research going places.
The foodie in me just really has to know, what do you think most people misunderstand about Amish cooking?
This is what surprises people the most. There's a lot of grocery store processed foods in Amish cooking.
Stop.
Yes, I know.
Heresy.
It is. You could find an Amish cookbook and find a can of cream of mushroom soup in almost every recipe. And it's true. There's a lot of processed food. There are a lot of scratch-made foods that are wonderful, but not everything is, you know, organic from scratch. There's a lot of grocery store stuff that surprises people.
Yeah. This is a good point to introduce some of the larger themes that you explored throughout the book about how people in these communities themselves interpret simplicity. How do you describe that to people when they ask?
For the Amish, it's a lot about cherry picking what works for them. For instance, they're not, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the Amish are completely anti-electricity.
They're Luddites. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not true. I mean, you can go through some Amish communities not far from here where you see solar panels, and they're using it to generate electricity. The problem they have is with the grid itself, because if you have electricity just coming into your house unpoliced.
Unbounded? Unbound, maybe?
Yeah, because you could get, you know, the internet and TV and all sorts of stuff. But if you can cherry pick, you know, there's nothing wrong with an electric refrigerator, most Amish would say. That's fine. It's the electric TV, computer, stuff like that.
The electric can opener?
I don't know that they would have a problem with that. It might seem a little frivolous in, you know.
And again, as we should probably say at several points in this interview, there are different interpretations in different communities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I ran into one Amish community in Tennessee. I was working on, we've done some cookbooks in the past, and most Amish don't like their photos being taken. Not all. But there was one lady who didn't want me to take photos of her, like, tomato plants. And, you know, there's no biblical basis for tomato plants having their photo taken, but she was adamant. So, you know, I respected that.
Yeah.
But then there was an Amish community in Michigan, Manton, which is a more progressive community, where I walked into an Amish store and he asked me to take his picture. Like, can you please take my picture? Okay.
I guess like every denomination, it's made up of people. And they have different beliefs and, you know, join different faith groups based on that. Can you give us a little background about how some of the plain people, as you put it in the title of the book, some ways that they support themselves in the 21st century?
If we use the umbrella of the plain people as a whole, 50 years ago, it was still largely agrarian, but it's changed a lot. I mean, you can go to, southern Michigan. You have a huge percentage of the Amish there that work in the factories of northern Indiana, the RV factories. So factory work is, and they work long shifts. Farming is still there, but you also see a lot of home-based businesses, a lot of construction crews. So it's just... I'd like to say that they, you know, are trying to start home-based businesses so they can stay close to home, but the factory work Amish sort of counter that argument. So you just see a wide variety depending on what's economically viable where they are.
Yeah.
Like in, up in, for instance, Manton, there's not a lot of factory work or Clare, Michigan. But down in the southern Michigan, factory work is very plentiful.
Yeah. Can you maybe think of an example in the book of a moment when you discovered one of these, you know, one or the other of these trades and you know, had questions about it and how those questions were answered?
I mean, there was a Mennonite man who, old order Mennonite, didn't have electricity, who was an electrician. I met an electrician. I mean, that's just kind of, that blew my mind. I'm like, how did you learn this? But he explained, and the Amish and Mennonites go to school generally to the eighth grade. That's it. Does not say a word about their intelligence, because I would put up the electrician Mennonite against, you know, anybody. He was just he observed and he learned. So that was striking. There was a German Baptist truck driver I met once, and that was surprising. I mean, they do drive cars in the German Baptist community, but, you know, over-the-road truck driver just doesn't, you know, the beard and the overalls and the suspenders, you don't quite picture a truck driver.
The story that you told us about photographs and photography, you know, some of this reaction is based in technology. And again, as I was reading, I also was reminded about how strange it must be to live your life with so much curiosity from the outside world. And I wonder about if you can give us a sense of what some people in communities had to say about this attention and the questions and the assumptions from the outside world towards their lifestyle.
I mean, some Amish are very willing ambassadors for their culture and their religion, and you have to find those ambassadors when you're in an Amish community. But the rank and file, generally, it puts a lot of pressure on them. You know, when people from the outside are like, oh, you know, they have all the answers, their simplicity, you know, I want to do that. And I think a lot of Amish are just like, why? You know, we're just living our lives. This is all we've ever known. So they don't understand. And then it puts pressure on them when outsiders sort of pedestalize them.
Are there some things that you've heard or you've asked about what families wanted for their lives or for their kids' lives over time?
I mean, you do find the goals of parenting a little more subdued, maybe in non-Amish culture than non-Amish culture. A family, a farm, land. You know, when it marriage, kids. The Amish are still very much a patriarchal society, still very much a role-based society. So you're not going to have, there are exceptions to everything, but you're not going to have most Amish parents saying, you know, gee, I hope Eli grows up to become a Hollywood film producer or something. I mean, those options are limited in Amish culture too. You're just not going to, you know, they want them to stay in the church and stay close to home.
Was there ever a point when you yourself thought about becoming a member of one of these communities? I mean, you've definitely been immersed in ways that a lot of us never will.
Yeah, I mean, there's another aspect to the book too that I talk about, which is like my ADHD tendencies. It took a long time for me to get there.
Get hands around. Yeah.
Yeah, and I look back at it, and maybe I've concluded there was a little bit of self-medication there. The Amish are slower. ADHD brains are faster. So maybe that was my way of, you know, tamping down on that. I was too plugged in to become. There are outsiders who have joined the Amish and they've been very successful. I knew I would never be one of those. The German Baptist Church, which embraces simplicity and plainness, but they also have the technology, that one appealed to me more. But I long ago realized, you know, you're not there, Kevin. you're just not there. There are very appealing aspects to that life, but you have to commit to it. And you really have to commit to it. I've met people who have successfully done it, and kudos to them.
How long was the actual text of the book in the works?
I started it literally 15 years ago.
Wow.
And a lot of it sat for a long time before I dusted it off and updated it, because I have an ending now. For a long time, I didn't have an ending. And I feel like I could finally put a capstone on the story. And that's why I finished it.
No spoilers. But I did want to ask if over that long, you know, that long life of the writing time, if there were questions that you had that you felt you were able to answer.
There are two parallel paths on that. The Amish are not perfect. I mean, I ran into Amish who, and they never proclaimed to be to perfection. We're the ones that sort of idealized them. But I learned that very much over the past 15 years is that they're just not perfect, and they have their flaws. I've seen the good and I've seen the bad in the Amish, just like anybody else. And with myself, I often went back and forth between, all right, am I doing Amish stuff for a living, or am I a journalist? And that was the cementing of my journalism. That's what I love. I love getting up in the middle of the night to cover a story, breaking news, that adrenaline rush. That's an ADHD thing too.
Tell me about it. Would you say that folks in these communities of Plain people consider their lifestyle settled?
No, I don't think they consider it settled at all. I think the debate about church rules is more robust than ever among the Amish. I've met many wonderful Amish families on this journey, and they've taught me a lot. But I don't think, for me, it's still, the Amish are still a work, just like me, just like everybody. They're still a work in progress.
I mean, like America.
Yes, they're still finding their way. And I bet you 30 years from now, there are Amish that are embracing artificial intelligence right now.
In what ways?
Well, to get answers. They will rely on non-Amish people to sort of get it for them, or they'll go to a library and use AI very eagerly, which is surprising. And you will see division in the Amish among that. Like some saying, whoa, and others saying, wait a minute, this is, we can get answers here to things.
What kinds of practical questions might they be looking for when people who do use those tools resort to them?
Encyclopedic answers, we've all used it, I think, or a lot of us, where it gives you, it's like an interactive encyclopedia. It gives you, it doesn't just give you the answer, it walks you through from point A to point B. And among the Amish, that's very appealing to a segment of them. And you're seeing a lot embrace that, interestingly.
You mean like, how do I solder two different kinds of pipes together, or what's the process for propagating this particular kind of plant? Or like, what? Seriously, like, what are the questions that...
A lot of them actually are more philosophical, like, where, like, how do we keep our kids not exposed to non-Amish ways? And you'd be surprised, I've entered that same question because I've heard some Amish people, that's one of the things they've asked. And, Claude or ChatGPT will give them a perspective they had not thought of before.
And again, not all simple people, not all within one group, but just this is something that you have observed people sometimes doing.
Yes. And Michigan is known for its what's called the Michigan Circle Amish. And they're a more liberal, progressive group. Manton is one of the places where you find them the most. You could go to some Amish communities and AI would be like, no way, absolutely nothing to do with it. And you are seeing sort of a taffy pool among the Amish, where the more progressive pulling this way, the more conservative pulling the other way. So you're seeing the church stretch, and that split will become more pronounced over the years ahead.
Kevin Williams is the author of Not So Simple, Adventures Among the Amish, Mennonites, Shakers, and Other Plain People. You can look for it at fine independent booksellers near you or at his website. Kevin, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You don't have to be living an alternative lifestyle to have something to share. We have a project called On Hand. It's a spin-off podcast that we use to answer people's questions about life in Michigan. Over the next few weeks, we'll be working on investigations into Superman ice cream, that most Midwestern of summertime scoops, and its mysterious blend of red, yellow, and blue flavors. How do you describe them? Also, the origins of the pasty, the UP's great culinary contribution to cold weather noshing. What's your family's favorite pasty recipe? You got some innovations on the hand pie that you'd like to tell us about? Or maybe a story about that time your sister actually tried dropping a pasty down the mineshaft to see if it would keep its form. Okay, maybe the less said about that experiment, the better. But do send us the stories you can tell, onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or go to the website for Michigan Public and find the On Hand page to use our easy submission form. That's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.